For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Genesis. Well, Genesis is, of course, as the title would suggest, a study of origins. This is something that everybody in every place throughout time has been concerned with. Who am I, after all, and where did I come from, and what am I made of, and what are my possibilities, and what kind of a world do we live in anyway, and what is my relationship to nature, and what is God like? And these real big questions are really at the foundation, ultimately, of all of our thinking. We're not consciously touching base with that, but that really is the way it is. All religions, all philosophies, all human thought ultimately comes down to assumptions in these real basic areas. And so the Bible, of course, begins with these things and has things to contribute along two lines, both in terms of the incredible contribution that the book of Genesis made in its original historic context, which we're going to tease out here this evening, and in the modern context, which we're going to talk about next week. Some of our most basic assumptions really come from the long shadow cast by the book of Genesis. And so we speak in our country of certain inalienable rights, endowed by whom? By our Creator, right? And so there is that assumption that we have rights, that people matter because there's a God in whose image we're made. Where does that come from? Uniquely from the pages of the Bible, from the book of Genesis. We think of broader questions about whether the universe is understandable or is it just pure chaos. The Bible speaks to that in its context about human dignity, about principles of justice, about who is God, about the workings of nature. The Bible stands both as an incredible source of insight and revolution in its Old Testament environment and in radical distinction to its environment, which we're going to talk about tonight, and in our own as well. That in a scientific age, a postmodern age that has viewed but to a large extent, the book of Genesis with contempt, we want to engage those questions and take them on in an honest and straightforward way next week. We're going to talk about the whole question of religion and faith. We're going to talk about science and the Bible from the book of Genesis. But as well as the contributions that we get from the book of Genesis, as we'll be careful to trace these things out, Genesis then and Genesis now offers an important challenge to the prevailing belief systems of people in every culture. The Bible is fundamentally unique in its characterization of who God is, what it means to know Him, what it means to be human. The whole concept, in fact, of history is rooted in the pages of the Scriptures. And so it's just with that broad introduction in mind and the understanding of the importance of the study that we are beginning to investigate, we want to introduce the first of a few weeks of our study of Genesis chapters 1, 2, and 3. So let's just get right into it. In verse 1, it says, and you could all close your eyes and say the same thing, I'm sure, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth, it says, was formless and void. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. And so I want to begin our study contemplating the creation narrative from its context in the ancient Near Eastern world. It's very important, I think, if we're going to understand the real meaning of this great text, to understand it first from the standpoint of what its original hearers understood it to be, and then, and we'll talk about this next week, its implications for the modern world. Let's begin with the Genesis in context. We note it says that there is a beginning, that there's a start, that the universe is finite and contingent on its existence to a transcendent source, something outside of the universe itself. Well, we're going to develop that thought a lot next week, and so we want to just move on and talk about the fact that in the beginning would have been understood in the mind of the ancient world as something a little bit revolutionary. A beginning. A beginning implies a start to things, a sequence of events, and an end. And that is something absolutely foreign to the ancient world with its cyclical view of history. The idea that there is just endless repetition, that one day merges into the next, one season into the next, one year into the next, and just as seasons change and repeat themselves over and over, so it was viewed in the ancient world that that's how reality works. There's no such thing as a linear idea beginning in a meaningful sequence of events that is moving toward a certain goal. But Genesis declares from the very beginning that there is a start followed by a meaningful sequence of events, the days of creation, that culminate in the last day, the seventh day, a day of rest, which become a sort of a window, a paradigm, a model, as it were, of the way that all of history will operate. That there is a beginning and there's a plan. There's a symmetry and an order, because God is not only the sovereign of creation, He is also the sovereign of history, as Genesis will declare to us. And that it is moving toward an end, the end that God has in view for it, the purpose for its being. And so just these very first words, the three words in the beginning, would have come to the mind of the ancient Near Eastern ear as something just fundamentally unheard of. What do you mean, a beginning? What do you mean that there's a sequence of events that are going someplace? And so here we find an important shift in literature, in human thought, in God's revelation, really, from myth to history. And I have on your overhead here a tablet. This is one of the six tablets of creation from the Sumerian myth, the Enuma Elish, sometimes viewed as the closest literary parallel to the book of Genesis in the six creative days. And I want to just say a few things about that, because many of us, I think, have been in the university classroom. We've read some things here and there that have basically asserted the idea that the Genesis creation story is nothing other than a mythological reworking of other ancient myths. And the Enuma Elish is the one that is always compared to the book of Genesis. But there are important differences that I want to bring out here, because I want us to understand the sharpness of what we find when we read the book of Genesis, the creation account. And so Robert Alter, who is without any question probably the leading student of ancient Semitic languages and of the Hebrew Bible, makes this point. He says the ancient Hebrew writers purposely nurtured and developed prose narration to take the place of the epic genre by which its content was intimately bound with the world of paganism. The recitation of epics by all of Israel's neighbors, all of the ancient people of antiquity in the Near East, the recitation of their epics, like the Enuma Elish and others, was tantamount to an enactment of cosmic events in the manner of sympathetic magic, in the process of a total rejection of the polytheistic religions and their ritual expressions. Epic songs and epic genre were purged from the repertoire of the Hebrew authors. This is a very important point, because Alter and other people who have studied this matter seriously, and as a professor at Stanford University, he's clearly the leader in this area. He wrote an important book some years ago called The Art of Biblical Narrative. And in it, he's making the point that the composition of the creation narrative, as with the rest of the Genesis narrative, is historical, not mythopoetic. It was not written from the standpoint of ancient Near Eastern religion, which was written for the purpose of reciting their origin stories and other stories in a manner of sympathetic magic. The idea here with Israel's neighbors is that their religious writing was in itself an act of worship, in that what they would do is they would repeat the stories and act them out in their worship. And so as nature fertility deities come together and either have battle or procreate and create elements of the cosmos and ultimately of man, then the worship of ancient paganism mimicked these things, and that's why you'd have whole cults of sacred prostitutes and sacrifices, including human sacrifice and things like that. And what Alter and others have pointed out is that the Genesis account is written not from the standpoint of mythopoetry, but rather prose narrative, historical narrative, not for the purpose of reenactment, but for the purpose of informing the reader about who is God, what is nature, and what does it mean to be human. And that is a fundamental difference in the composition of these things. Alexander Heidel, who was the translator of the Enuma Elish and a longtime resident in the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago, wrote a book called The Babylonian Genesis, and in it he makes this point. He said, comparing Genesis to any of the mythologies of creation in the ancient Near Eastern world is a poor comparison. And especially, he points out the Enuma Elish, which he says, yes, it's true that there are six tablets of creation in the Enuma Elish. And some have said, well, that corresponds to six creative days in the book of Genesis. But he further makes the point that they are so different, it would be like saying there's a relationship between the 12 months of the year and the 12 patriarchs of Israel because they both have 12 in them. And that's just about how similar these pieces are. And I think I can just only suggest, if it's a question in your mind, to run to the library and read the Enuma Elish and the other myths that are like it, because you will see immediately how vastly different these things are from the book of Genesis. Now, what we have in the creation account, which is again in just such profound contrast to the ancient world in which it was written, is the idea of a God standing outside of nature, not a part of nature, but transcendent, beyond space and time, beyond the physical order. And so in this way, we have the emergence of something completely new and without parallel in the ancient world. The ancient world was full of animism, polytheism, the personification of nature, the belief that there is no separation between the spiritual world and the natural world, and so various aspects of nature were therefore worshipped. And so animals, rain, the land, the ocean, all things, ancestors, were venerated and they were worshipped as gods. And gods in whose power all humans were bound. And the Genesis creation account simply is saying, no, that's not the way it is. That God is not a part of nature, not reducible to an element within nature, but transcends nature itself. That there is no primeval battle in the bringing about of the universe, as all mythologies universally have held, that the gods get into a battle, the loser of the battle is slain, cut into pieces, that the universe really consists in the aspects of the dismembered god's body, and that explains the way it is. There's no battle, no drama. It's just anticlimactic how Genesis begins. It just says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God said, it was so, and it was good. And that's how it goes. It's very anti-mythological in its meaning. There is in the... yeah, it's funny. In the ancient Near Eastern world, all gods had consorts. There's always a female counterpart to the male. Interestingly, in the Genesis creation account, uniquely in that way, there is no genealogy. There's no question of where does God come from, because God has always been. There's no parallel to God, no consort, no female version of God. There is, interestingly, in the Hebrew language, no word for Goddess. It simply doesn't exist. And the first of the prohibitions that God gives to his people is to not build idols or resemblances of him. Why? Because God cannot be reduced to the image of man or to anything in the created order. God is transcendent. And so in this way, I want you to understand the radical departure that we are getting from the book of Genesis in relation to everything that existed in the ancient world. So radical is this departure that we can conclude with G.E. Wright, one of the great archaeologists of the last century. He says it is impossible to see how this God of Israel could have evolved slowly from polytheism. The two faiths rest on entirely different foundations, totally different assumptions about everything that matters, the nature of nature, the nature of the gods, and so forth. The religion of Israel suddenly appears in history, breaking radically with the mythopoetic approach to reality. There is no evolution in the developing of Israel's religion. There's no transition from the primitive animistic polytheism of Israel's neighbors to the high monotheism, the transcendent personal God introduced to us in Genesis chapter 1. It simply doesn't exist. And I think that that's one of many reasons why people like G.E. Wright and others who have spent their entire lives in the study of comparative ancient Near Eastern religion have concluded that the uniqueness of the Bible from the very beginning is evidence of the reality of the God about which it attests. I think that there's something true to that in that statement. Where did this come from? Not as a figment of man's imagination, but as a matter of divine revelation itself. Moving on, the real point of the story of creation is salvation. The whole story of the Bible is the story of salvation, of God rescuing his creation that has run amok. And the beginning, act one in this incredible story, is the creation account itself. And I want us to think about this a little bit carefully here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then verse 2 begins with "and." Well, you say, that's interesting. It's so uninteresting that most of our translations don't even include the "and." It just makes it hard to read. But the "and" is there, and it matters, because it is a conjunction in the Hebrew language, which is called a vav. And it's an "and" statement that really means "then." And it's a vav circumstantial. It's like, I walked in the door, and there were hundreds of people. You see, it doesn't progress the story. It just explains what's going on. It explains the circumstance. And that's exactly the force of this "and" here. And so in the beginning, God creates the heavens and the earth. And there's a circumstance. And the circumstance is that the earth was formless and void. What does this mean? Well, we note first that the creation account in Genesis 1 and 2 is a selective account. For instance, there is no creation of the angels mentioned. It just says heaven and earth. There is no mention of the existence of God's adversary, Satan. These are assumed by Moses as the author to his original audience and go without explanation in the narrative of creation. But there's an important role to play here, because this expression, formless and void, presumes a catastrophic problem. The expression tohu wabohu, formless and void in the Hebrew, is used in the Bible to express conditions of disaster, of catastrophe, of something terribly wrong. And so we read, for instance, in Jeremiah chapter 4, my soul, I am in anguish. Because why? Because Jeremiah is seeing the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Is that the end of God's program on the earth? Look at the destruction, the despair. He says, disaster on disaster is proclaimed. The whole land is devastated. And I looked on the earth, and behold, it was formless and void, and the heavens, and they had no light. It's exactly the same language as Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. And it's an idiom. It's a figure of speech. It's this formless and void, that it's chaos, that it's death, that it's lifelessness. And so the creation narrative is assuming circumstances where something has gone terribly wrong. We know this as well because Isaiah tells us in Isaiah 45, verse 18, "Thus says the Lord who created the heavens, He is the God who formed the earth and made it. He established it and did not create it a waste place, but formed it to be inhabited." What happened? What's the circumstance that our author is pointing to? The backstory here is important. The backstory is one of cosmic revolt. And it's left to the prophet Ezekiel to give us that pre-creation story that Moses did not include. In Ezekiel 28, and speaking of God's adversary, Satan, he says, "You had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. You were the anointed angel who covers, and I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God." And so God tells us of the greatness of this powerful, wise, beautiful, angelic being placed in Eden, placed on earth. And then he says, "You were blameless in your ways from the day that you were created." He's not co-equal to God. He's a created being by God. "You were blameless from the day that you were created until unrighteousness was found in you." He says, "You were internally filled with violence." Internally filled with violence, something of the heart. "Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor." What is he describing here? He's describing a great being who becomes aware of his greatness and then begins to ask this question, "So what about God? I'm great. I'm sufficient. I'm enough. I'm beautiful. I should be the object of the adoration of all of creation, not God." Pride. The pride of the Creator. That is the essence of what's being described here. That's the beginning of all corruption. God goes on to say, "By the multitude of your iniquities, you profaned your sanctuary. You laid your sanctuaries to waste." What is his sanctuary? It's the earth. It's Eden. And so that very earthbound description of the creation narrative in Genesis 1 presumes a general knowledge that the cosmos that God created has fallen into decay and corruption, to lifelessness and to chaos. But it is from that context then, in verse 2, that it says, and while the earth was formless and void, that's not the end of the story. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving. The Spirit of God, always associated with the saving work of God, the bringing about of life from death. And so God is on the move in his now devastated creation, his universe that has been shattered by revolt. And what does he do? Then he begins to speak life and order into the creation. And so we're given the 6 days of creation. "Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness." I've underlined three things. God said, there was, and it was good. Why do I do that? Because that's the pattern in the creation narrative. How does God create? He simply declares, let there be. The Word of God has this kind of power to bring about what does not exist. Then it was. And then there is an assessment, an evaluation of the thing, that what God has made is good. And so God called the light day, the darkness night, there is evening and morning one day. Then God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the water above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and morning a second day. Then God said, let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, fruit trees on the earth bearing fruit after their own kind. And it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their own kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and morning, a third day. Then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate day from night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light to the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. And he made the stars also. God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light to the earth and govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, a fourth day. Then God said, let the waters teem with swarming of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth and open expanse of heaven. And God created great sea monsters and every living thing that moves with which the waters swarm after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the waters of the seas, let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, a fifth day. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle, creeping things, beasts of the earth after their kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after their kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created man, male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which is yielding seed, and it shall be food for you, and every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth which has life. I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw what he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. And there is the story of creation. Now, let's again probe just a little deeper. We want to talk next week about some of the controversy concerning the creation narrative. Today, I just want to talk about it in its literary and historic context, and to make this observation that when we look at the 6 days of creation, we are looking at an important literary device called parallelism, that the way that the narrative is constructed deals directly with the conditions that the universe had come to prior to these 6 creative days, namely the formlessness and the void, the chaos, the anarchy that was the universe and its lifelessness. And out of that, the 6 creative days are God speaking conditions that overcome those conditions of chaos and of lifelessness in the following way. That day one, God overcomes the chaos of darkness by creating day 4 luminaries, right? Day 2 corresponds to day 5, separating the water from the skies overcomes the chaos introduced by undifferentiated waters, which enables then the creation of fish and birds to live in that habitat. Day 3 and day 6 overcome both the chaos that was and the lifelessness that was by creating land and vegetation on the third day, and the beasts of the earth and humans to dwell in it on the sixth. And I think that that's a fairly clear example of the sort of parallelism that we read all over Hebrew writing. It's identical in form, in fact, to teaching of Jesus, actually, in Luke chapter 6, who taught in a very different context. He's talking about poverty and wealth, and he runs through a discussion that is in form exactly like the narrative of Genesis 1, and it's made to be interpreted in this kind of parallelistic pattern. And this, I think, is where it is. And I think viewing it from this context avoids some of the strange controversies that have often arisen out of how people interpret the book of Genesis, which again we'll talk about next week, but which I'm just putting forward to you here, makes sense out of what really is going on there. What we have in the creation account is the assertion of a sovereign God who is sovereign over all forces of nature. Because he is transcendent, he is also sovereign. That in historic context also matters profoundly. Let's think about the ancient Near Eastern world, which worshipped and gave their lives to forces of nature, forces that they thought were personalities that guided every aspect of their being. What the Genesis narrative brings is freedom from fear and freedom from bondage. Let me tell you that the majority of the world today still thinks animistically and polytheistically. It doesn't take a very long trip from Columbus, Ohio, to find ourselves in populations where people feel that every aspect of their life is governed by spiritual personalities that are greater than them, that are essentially aspects of nature itself. Whether that's older relatives that have died or aspects of nature, trees and so forth, the streams. This is the way most of the world views themselves, as utterly subject to the powers of spirits that animate nature and that are greater than themselves, and in whose life they are in complete fear and bondage. And there is something powerful today, just as there was in 1500, 1400 BC, when Moses compiled this great narrative, that God, who is transcendent and sovereign over nature, has an answer to fear and to bondage that comes from those who fear these very processes of nature itself. And to see people liberated from that fear and from the spiritual bondage that holds them is a powerful and beautiful thing. And we're going to talk about that next week too, because there is a similar kind of fear and bondage that exists in a materialistic Western world where we think that the only ultimate is matter acting on matter in the context of space and time. Humanity is in bondage and we live in fear. That is at the heart of what we are about. We don't want to live this way. We want to find freedom, but we are bound by those things that we worship, those things that we think are the ultimate. And when those things are the ultimate instead of the God who is there, we're in bondage. More on that later. But let's just put it this way, as Bruce Waltke does in his Theology of the Old Testament. He says, what Genesis 1 is undertaking and accomplishing is a kind of radical and sweeping affirmation of monotheism. Each day of creation dismisses an additional cluster of deities. On the first day, the gods of light and darkness are dismissed. On the second day, the gods of sky and sea. On the third day, earth gods and gods of vegetation. On the fourth day, the sun, the moon, and star gods. The fifth and sixth days take away associations with divinity from the animal kingdom. So the creation account offers itself as an incredible polemic a denunciation of all of Israel's religious neighbors. You're worshiping that which is not God. And our narrative of creation exists to show you that there is only one God who is sovereign over all things. Imagine Moses' generation, the generation that follows Moses, is going to go into this land of Canaan, and it is going to be inhabited by these people who are worshiping facets of nature. And the first place they're going to go is this place called Jericho. And Jericho gets its name from Yairoch, the god of the moon. And so you think about what is really at stake in the conquest narrative and the Exodus narrative from Egypt. All of these things are the assertion of the sovereign, transcendent God of history and God of creation over all possible rivals to himself. And that's exactly how the earliest readers of Genesis understood a text like this. There is only one absolute, only one ultimate, and it is God, and he is sovereign over all contenders. Then finally we move to the apex, the crown of creation, which is the existence of humanity, about which we'll have much more to say next week. But let's begin with the starting point of what does it mean to be human. The book of Origins is all about, why do I matter? Where did I come from? What am I made of? And Genesis answers this decisively. You and I are in the image of an infinite and personal God. That there is a basis for human dignity. Think about that. Heidel, in his book, The Babylonian Genesis, comparing Genesis with the other creation stories, makes this point. He says, the purpose of man's creation is conditioned by the general purpose of the universe. Of course, it must be. According to the Enuma Elish, the universe was created for the benefit of the gods. Man's creation was conceived and executed not as an end in itself or as a natural sequel to the formation of the rest of the universe, but rather as an expedient to satisfy a group of discontented gods. Man was made to be the servant of the gods, to be a kind of breadwinner of his divine masters, and to be the builder and caretaker of their sanctuaries. Why do you exist? Because gods, arguing and bickering among themselves, are too lazy to make their own lunch. So we're going to create humans to offer up sacrifices, and that's going to be what the gods need. And so there's that mutually parasitic relationship going on between the gods and humanity. And just how profoundly different, my friends, how profoundly different this is to the biblical understanding of human origins. Where do human dignity and human rights come from? You know, we need to think about that question. We put that out there all the time. We talk about human rights. We're a rights-based culture. Well, I believe in human rights, but what's the basis of those human rights? Is it that we are more sophisticated than other animal species? Is it that we are stronger than other members of our society? More complex? What is the real basis to say of some person, no matter who that person is, you have rights. You matter. What allows us to say that? Not because nature confers these rights upon us. Nature's not just. And nature does not provide equality. There are always stronger. Always. Is it just that, well, society has decided that you're okay, that you're included, that you have rights? Well, what happens when society says you don't? As it does through every age of human history, what is the real basis for that understanding, that universal human awareness? My life matters. And here, uniquely in the pages of Genesis chapter 1, is the only plausible explanation that you are in the image of the infinite personal God. No other substitute for that foundation will ever fill our own intuitive understanding of our own importance and the importance of all humanity. And deviating from this in any conscious way will always diminish human life. We'll talk about that more next week. Genesis says that God creates humanity in his own image and blesses man. Not creates man as an unfortunate byproduct or something like that, but God's intent in creation is for human blessing, to be fruitful and to multiply. That there's a spiritual aspect to humanity, that we're created in the image of God, and that explains, because God is personal, that there is this expression, our image, because there is within God three persons in one essence, and that God has lived forever as a triunity and can speak then of human personality in terms of both male and female, the complementary nature of gender. Man is different in kind, not merely complexity, to the animals. And lastly, that there's a stewardship God gives. Fill the earth, subdue it, rule it. A stewardship over God's good creation. We're not slaves to nature, but we are shareholders in God's creation. Now let's just bring it all to a conclusion here. Three points of application that I think make this story an enduring and an incredibly important one, even for us today. First, that life is a gift, not an inevitability or an accident. That God spoke existence into being. He spoke human life into being. Not because it's the inevitable outcome of a biological process that is blind to meaning or purpose, but simply because he chose, because of his own nature, to make beings in his likeness. I love the way the psalmist puts it in Psalm 33. The earth is full of the loving kindness of the Lord. The hesed, the covenant loyalty, affection, and grace of God. And the psalmist is saying that's what animates the purposes of God, even in creation. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all of their hosts. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. So there's that life is a profound gift. Not something that we deserve, not something that just happens. You're here not by accident, but because God has chosen to make you in his likeness. You matter. Second, human uniqueness and human dignity, again, is the point of this story. Psalm 8 says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon, the stars which you've ordained, what is man that you would take thought of him, and the son of man that you care for him? The vastness of the universe, and then there's pitiful little earth. And on pitiful little earth is teeny little people. Just seems so inconsequential. But the psalmist goes on, you have made him little lower than God and have crowned him with glory and majesty. Wow, that's humanism in a different sense. That's biblical humanism. That's the highest possible statement of the dignity of man. You made him to rule over the works of your hand. You have put all these things under your feet. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And so just viewing our own frame and who we are gives rise to a deep appreciation of the Creator that has made us. Now lastly, creation reflects the one eternal transcendent God's intent in history. In history and his power to deliver. And the Old Testament always brings together the God of creation with the God of history. Why? Because we can look at creation and attribute it to the powerful hand of God. But what about history? Where is history going? And whose care is history? And the Old Testament, the book of Genesis, all of Scripture is intent on our understanding that just as nature is the product of an intelligent design, an omnipotent power, and a benevolent sovereign, so too is history. And so, For instance, in the trusting in God's power to deliver, Isaiah can say this, or Jeremiah rather, ask me about the things to come concerning my sons, and I shall commit, and you shall commit to me the work of my hands. This is Isaiah. It is I who made the earth and created man upon it. Okay, so he's asking this question in the context of the coming Babylonian slaughter of Israel. What's going to happen? Ask me about my sons, he says, and I'm going to remind of my work in creation. I stretched out the heavens with my hand, and I ordained all their host. And then he says, I will make all his ways smooth. Now talking about the liberation that will come at the end of their captivity. And he will build my city and will let my exiles go free without payment or reward, says the Lord of hosts. Just as I have been sovereign in creation, I am sovereign in history. There is no power on this earth greater than mine. And what I have promised, I will deliver. Yes, you are going into captivity, but you will return. I am sovereign. And I will make that happen. Powerful. Then there is also the creation narrative as a prefiguring of the very end of history. And so our same author in Isaiah says, behold, I create a new heavens and a new earth. And the former things will not be remembered or come to mind. Be glad and rejoice forever in what I create. You know, it's interesting to note, if you look carefully at the Bible, that all of the language of creation in Genesis chapters 1 and 2 comes back in the book of Revelation at the end. Isn't that interesting? And why is that? Why is it that in Revelation we have an end to days and nights because God is their light? Why is it that we have the tree of life and the city of Jerusalem constituting a new Eden, and all of the imagery of creation comes back at the end? Because the Bible is a unit of thought. It is linear history. It begins with an act of creation salvation and ends with a resolution to history, with a resolution to God's plan of salvation, making all things as God intended. It's one story. And that's all I got to say about that. Let's come back next week. We're going to talk about the kind of the modern engagement with the creation narrative. We're going to talk about creationism and science.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.